Hey, Prime members, you can listen to That Scene with Dan Patrick ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
It's a dinosaur.
I hadn't realized until I saw the film how close those kids come to death.
Yeah.
On several occasions.
Yeah.
Not the least of them being when the T-Rex turns up and tries to eat them in the car.
There's some bad parenting going on here, Sam. Hi, I'm Dan Patrick, and this is IMDb's That Scene with Dan Patrick, an Amazon original. The podcast where I talk to some of Hollywood's top actors, directors, and producers about some of their most iconic scenes that have defined their careers, helped shape the cinematic landscape, and have even become fixtures in pop culture. On today's show, we're joined by New Zealand actor, writer, producer, director, and vineyard proprietor Sam Neill. Sam is something of a genre darling, starring in such cult classics as The Omen 3, In the Mouth of Madness, The Hunt for Red October, and Event Horizon. Yet that didn't stop him from starring in one of the biggest blockbuster films of all time, Jurassic Park. The movie was released in 1993, directed by Steven Spielberg, and the cast, alongside Sam, includes Laura Dern, Jeff Goldblum, Richard Attenborough, and Samuel L. Jackson. That film was made for $63 million and went on to earn over $1 billion at the box office. The scene in question today is where paleontologist Dr. Alan Grant, played by Sam, sees a dinosaur in person for the first time, something he has to take his sunglasses off to truly see to believe. When you look back on Jurassic Park, how did you first get that script?
I'm not entirely sure why it came to me. I know the film that Stephen thought was that sort of piqued his interest in me. It was a film called Dead Calm with Nicole Kidman and Billy Zane. He liked that film a lot. And I was on the way through Los Angeles. I was going to do a film with Angelica Houston it was called Family Pictures, something like that, a miniseries that we shot in Toronto. And my agent said, look, Steven Spielberg would like to meet you. Would you go to his house this afternoon before you get the plane? So I went over to Steven's, shook his hand. I looked at some of his paintings, which were really good. We had a nice chat. I got back on the plane, didn't think any more about it, really. And then about 2 weeks later, my agent called and said, you've got the part, and you'll be starting on that as soon as you finish up there in Toronto. You know, and about a week later, a guy turned up and fitted me with a blue shirt and an iconic hat. And about 4 weeks after that, I was in Hawaii, and we started to shoot the film. We were there for 2 or 3 weeks, and then a hurricane came through and destroyed our sets, and we shot the rest in Los Angeles. But it was a very bonding experience. Jeff and Laura became very good friends in the course of that. And we've just finished making another one of these films in Pinewood, and it was lovely to be back with those two because they're sweethearts, you know.
What do you think Stephen saw in you?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Stephen. I don't know. It was slightly perplexing on the first day or two because on that first day, the word came through. I had to do an American accent. So I thought, oh, well. I'll do my American accent, and a nice woman came up and worked with me between shots and stuff up in Toronto while we were shooting. I had it pretty much under control, I think, by the time I got to Hawaii. And Stephen said, sort of halfway through the first morning, you know that American accent? Forget about it. I said, oh, really? Great. He said, yeah, just use your own voice. I said, oh, thank you, Stephen. That's a real load off my shoulders. So I reverted to my voice, whatever that is. And then on day three, he said, you know that voice you're using now? I said, yeah, my voice. He said, yeah, just not so much.
Hey, Alan, if you wanted to scare the kid, you could have pulled a gun on him, you know.
Yeah, I know. Kids. You want to have one of those?
I don't want that kid, but a breed of child Dr. Grant could be intriguing. I mean, what's so wrong with kids?
Oh, Ellie, look, they're noisy, they're messy, they're expensive.
Cheap, cheap.
They smell.
They do not
smell. Some of them smell. Babies smell.
So then I'm sort of stuck halfway between. I thought it's a sort of a strange hybrid. And I've justified this in my mind that Alan Grant was probably born in Montana but spent 30 years digging up bones in Australia or something.
And he had a hint of an accent then.
I don't know what the hell that voice is.
But, you know, Sam, you downplay this whole – I went to Spielberg's house. That's a big deal. The least I would think it would be, you just go, yeah, I went there and we talked and I got on a plane and I didn't know if I'd hear from him. And then next thing I know, I got the part.
I didn't really expect to get this part. And it's just one of those things. I don't think it was transformative in any way. It was a pleasure to do. And I loved working with Stephen. Stephen is half Hollywood mogul and half, you know, the kid from E.T. He has this marvelous kind of childlike curiosity and playfulness that is completely engaging.
Oh, so he's like Elliot.
Yeah, it's kind of is. You know, there's half of him is the kind of head of a studio, and the other half is this kind of wonderful sort of innocent. And that's a wonderful kind of mixture. Look, no one knows how to make a film like Steven Spielberg. He's a complete master of his game. But he's also wonderfully playful and, you know, things make him joyous.
Listen,
Tim.
Tim, which car were you planning on?
Whichever one you are. Have you heard about this thing in Omni? About this, meteor making all this heat, and it made a bunch of diamond dust, and that changed the weather, and they died because of the weather. And then my teacher told me about this other book by a guy named Backer, and he...
The first dinosaur that Alan Grant sees, he then takes his sunglasses off. Was that in the script?
No, and I honestly can't remember why I did that, except I knew I couldn't convey the full effect of seeing something that you've only imagined in your dreams. And there it is. With my glasses on. So in order to fully express all those emotions that are coursing through him, you had to take the glasses off. I mean, it makes no sense, really, when you think about it. It's a bright day. You need your sunglasses. You're looking up into the sun. Wear the damn glasses. But, you know, from an acting point of view, taking off the glasses conveys so much more.
You know, it wasn't enough that you just see this dinosaur for the first time. You got to take off your sunglasses to make sure you've seen this dinosaur for the first time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It works.
Because you couldn't have identified that that's a dinosaur with your sunglasses on. Once you took them off, now we believed you. Like, oh, boy. Okay. Now the movie's on.
Yeah. It's become a sort of meme now, unfortunately, that people, you know, there's Alan Grant looking at all kinds of things on the internet, unfortunately.
How fast are they?
Well, we clocked the T-Rex at 32 miles an hour.
T-Rex?
Mm-hmm.
You said you've got a T-Rex?
Uh-huh. Say again. We have a T-Rex.
Wow.
Put your head between your knees.
Dr. Grant. My dear Dr. Sattler, welcome to Jurassic Park.
I was wondering this, that when would we first see dinosaurs in Jurassic Park? So it's about 20 minutes in, and then I was juxtaposing that with the first time we saw Jaws, when we first saw the shark, and Spielberg waited an hour and 20 minutes. And I was curious about that because the buildup, the anticipation, the in our minds thinking about Jaws, whereas the dinosaurs just happened early or earlier than I thought.
Yeah, but I think I'm right in saying it's 45 minutes before any bad shit happens. That's quite a long time to wait for, you know, the fun ride, you know.
I was also surprised PG-13. I didn't know if you thought about that at all. Like, dinosaurs, kids love dinosaurs, but is it a kids movie?
The PG-13, I think, is probably well advised, because I hadn't realized until I saw the film how close those kids come to death.
Yeah.
On several occasions.
Yeah.
Not the least of them being when the T-Rex turns up and tries to eat them in the car.
There's some bad parenting going on here, Sam.
Sam! Sam! Don't move! You can't see us if we don't move.
And then there's me and the kid in the tree with a Jeep, you know, the Jeep comes close to crushing us both, you know. Yeah, there's the kitchen is horrifying, you know, with that hiding behind the oven. And those velociraptors that just want to eat them for breakfast.
Just an appetizer.
Yeah.
There's no dinosaurs there when you're filming those scenes.
Oh, no, there's dinosaurs there. And one of the refreshing things about doing number 6 was how much these enormous animatronic creatures are back. And for instance, when the T-Rex is there in that first scene and it's trying to crush the car and eat the children therein, we had the big T-Rex right there. And it's not always 100% accurate where the creature comes in. And there were a couple of times when this immense dinosaur overstepped his mark and crashed its head into the car. And what would happen then was that the teeth would fall out of the T-Rex and they'd have to pick up these teeth. There were several times when the T-Rex had to have its teeth put back in.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Have they gone back to the practical effects in the new one?
Yeah, very much so. There's some really, really great animatronics in this new one, as well as computer-generated effects as well. I think that was one of the really great things about that first film was the use of both. Because a big three-dimensional moving creature helps you believe the computer-generated shot that comes after that, you know, and vice versa.
I also think, you know, Spielberg did such a great job blending both, which is probably why the movie still holds up now. A lot of times we'll see special effects and we'll go, it doesn't hold up. But it feels like, well, I just watched it yesterday, and I still get that feeling that it's relatively new.
Yeah, and also, you know, I mean, he's just a master storyteller. If you think about the first Alien film, if you make comparisons with that, it's sometimes what you don't see which is a more frightening than what you do see. Mm-hmm. So when you see, for instance, in that first scene, the dangling rope, the goat is dead. And you get shaking movement on a glass because something really big is coming. Those are really scary things.
Yeah.
There's nothing to see, but they're really frightening.
Where's the goat?
Oh.
I go back to Jaws, though, Sam? It was about what is it? What's it look like? How big is it? It wasn't as scary when I saw Jaws, the shark, but prior to that, I was scared.
That's what great thrillers are, you know. That's it's building tension and teasing you. I mean, a lot of these big special effects films now, you know, you can destroy cities and stomp all over them and kill millions of people in 30 seconds. But they make me want to go to sleep. It's all effects and no story.
Were you ever truly scared during the shooting?
I don't think so. I think there's quite a lot of physical stuff to do, and there were heights and things like that. But you're looked after so thoroughly, so comprehensively by the stunt guys, the stunt coordinators, that there's never any need to be fearful. And I really enjoyed those action sequences. They were a lot of fun.
What was rehearsal like?
I don't remember us doing any rehearsal. I don't think we did. We talked about things, but I don't think we had any rehearsals. I think we just started shooting it. So much of the film was already in Steven's head. And also, you know, there were big pin boards with shots. So Steven could refer to that. We need shot 5, which is a close-up of the tire or something, or there'll be a puddle with a big foot comes into it, something like that. Almost all of the film, I think, had been storyboarded. No, I don't remember doing any rehearsals as such. We would have very good discussions at the beginning of the day, but I don't think we rehearsed anything, really.
Are you allowed to elaborate on your character, add, subtract to your character? How does that work with someone like Steven?
I have to say, against myself, I hadn't really worked out what you needed to do or to be a fully formed action hero in the first film. I hadn't had time to ever really actually think what that was, because there are certain things that you need for that. In terms of performance, what everyone thinks of the film, I think I'm actually better in Jurassic 3, because I'd had 7 years to think about what I should have done. When we came to this film last year, Jurassic World Dominion, I'm very fond of Chris Pratt, and we had a couple of talks over drinks about all that. And I'm fascinated by him because he's really thought out what you need to do to be that action leading man. He's got it all worked out. And it's all these things that I hadn't considered.
Like what?
About what you do with your body, you know, what angles work that make you look dominant in a frame. These were complete surprises to me because he's really analyzed it. And he's really, really good at it. I take my hat off to him. He really deserves where he's got to. He works hard at it. He's very good at it. And he's a lovely guy. So full credit to him.
I was wondering about what you said a couple of minutes ago, that you are an action hero, but when you shot the first one, you didn't realize that you're an action hero? Did you have to be told that you're an action hero?
I sort of thought, gee, I'm the guy in the hat in this one. What do you do? Steven pretty much trusted me to sort of do it on my own. But I'd kind of thought, well, Steven knows how to direct guys in hats.
As Harrison Ford will attest to.
Yeah. I think Harrison's got it worked out too. When I finished the film, I wasn't really terribly happy with what I'd done. But I think, as I say, I think I'd got it sort of worked out by the third, but it's a bit late by then, isn't it?
Okay, it's not too bad, right, Tammy?
Yes, it is.
It's just like coming out of a treehouse. Did your dad ever build you a treehouse?
No.
Damn it. The thing about climbing is you never, never look down.
This
never.
Is impossible.
So?
How am I going to do this?
I'm going to help you with the footing. Oh, no.
Going back to Harrison Ford, I believe he was offered the part.
Oh, that's heartbreaking to hear. I don't want to know that. Yeah, he would have been great.
He would have known how to look at the camera, Sam.
Yeah. That's right.
Don't worry. They made the right call. Did you keep any props from the movie?
Yeah, I've got the claw in that scene where I scare the kid.
And even the word raptor means bird of prey.
That doesn't look very scary. More like a 6-foot turkey.
A turkey, huh? Okay. Try to imagine yourself in the Cretaceous period. You get your first look at this 6-foot turkey as you enter a clearing. He moves like a bird, lightly bobbing his head. And you keep still because you think that maybe his visual acuity is based on movement like T-Rex. And he'll lose you if you don't move. But no, not Velociraptor. You stare at him, and he just stares right back. And that's when the attack comes, not from the front, but from the side. From the other two raptors, you didn't even know were there. Because Velociraptor's a pack hunter, you see. He uses coordinated attack patterns, and he is out in force today. And he slashes at you with this 6-inch retractable claw, like a razor, on the middle toe. He doesn't bother to bite your jugular like a lion, say. No, no. He slashes at you here, or maybe across the belly, spilling your intestines. The point is, you are alive when they start to eat you. So, you know, try to show a little respect.
Oh, and I kept the boots. I kept Alan Grant's boots from the first one, and I'd forgotten about that. And I found them in a cupboard the other day, and I think I might put them up for auction and give the money to charity or something for out-of-work actors or something.
What do people say to you when they see you on the street? Do they quote movie lines to you?
Not a lot. I mean, I just look like an ordinary guy, and people don't bug me much. I've had to reflect a little in the last day or two because I've done a few of these interviews, and apparently it's 50 years since I first committed my mug to celluloid. It's a long time to be in the film business one way or another. And I have quite a number of friends who are genuinely famous, and they've done extremely well, but they can't actually go anywhere. They need security. They go into a restaurant and the restaurant stops and people go nuts. And they're very wealthy, but they're people, they get paid very well to be at that sort of level. But I don't think you could actually pay me enough to go through that ordeal. I can live like anyone else. But those famous friends I'm talking about cannot do that. Their lives are completely prescribed. And they do get paid a lot of money, but I don't think it's enough for you know, the curtailment of freedom that that involves.
How did your life change after Jurassic Park as far as notoriety?
Just business as usual, you know, and I'd already been, you know, making movies for 15 years at that point, and I've continued to do so since that time, and no great change.
But sometimes it's how people react to you. Like, you may not change, but people, their attitudes towards you change or their perceptions of you change. Did you experience any of that?
If it had changed, I think that would have upset me. It would have been disturbing. But no, it didn't catapult me into having an entourage and a couple of big security guys. That there was no necessity for that.
You weren't one of People Magazine's 50 Sexiest Guys or any of that? You weren't involved in any of that stuff?
No. I've never been one of the sexiest men alive, no.
What are you doing wrong, Sam? I mean,
yeah, that's right.
Tell me about your new movie. Tell me about Rams. How did Rams start out and become something on a page?
Actually, Rams has a genesis in an Icelandic film of the same name. Which is about 6 years old now. It's a film I like very much. And I wasn't really interested in a remake, not remotely, until I read the script and I realized it had a very different tone from the Icelandic film, which is pretty bleak, dry and funny, but bleak all the same. Whereas the film that we ended up making is very different in tone. And while it has some sad moments and some very poignant moments. It's also pretty funny at times, and you end up feeling better at the end of it. That's what I felt when I read the script. I felt better at the end of it. So it's been on release in Australia and New Zealand. It's been nice to get that feedback. People come out of it feeling better about life. And Jeremy Sims, who directed it, he also sort of talked me into it. I did four films back to back that year. That was 2018. A little over 2 years ago when we were shooting this, I was pretty exhausted by the end of it. But I'm glad I did it because I'm getting such warmth and back. The feedback is really good. And it's been got a 5-star review in the Sydney Morning Herald. I mean, that never happens.
Nice.
So, nice. Yeah.
Before I let you go, can you clear up something? How did they let Sean Connery get away with his accent in The Hunt for Red October? Like, he was allowed to, he didn't have to learn. Like, you were convincing.
That was curious, that film, because they said, no accents, just speak with your own voice. And a lot of the rest of the crew were on our Russian boat, were Eastern European of one kind or another, so they didn't have to do anything. Sean just does what he wants, basically. But I thought, no, I can't do this with a New Zealand accent. That's absurd. So I just sort of, against orders, really, I just sort of slipped a bit of, not a real accent, but just a bit of Russian tone into it, just to sort of take the curse off of New Zealand, you know.
Then I will live in Montana, and I will have a pickup truck, or possibly even a recreational vehicle. In winter, I will live in Arizona. Actually, I think I will need two wives.
Oh, at least.
Congrats on the movie. Thank you for reminiscing a little bit here. And Sam, we appreciate your time.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much. It's lovely to talk to you.
New episodes of IMDb's That Scene with Dan Patrick are available exclusively on Amazon Music. Please make sure to follow us in the Amazon Music app to get every episode. IMDb's That Scene with Dan Patrick was created, hosted, and produced by me, Dan Patrick. It's also produced by Brendan Pike, edited by Nathan Moody, and executive produced by Paul Anderson, Nick Pinella, and Andrew Greenwood for Workhouse Media. IMDb's That Scene with Dan Patrick is a production of Dan Patrick Productions and IMDb in association with Workhouse Media.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to That Scene with Dan Patrick ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.